Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a visitor from a long way away, from Vienna in Austria. His name is Thilo Hoffmann. He's a professor of environmental geosciences at that university and is an authority on water. And what's so big about water? You can add it to a little drink called whiskey, and that makes it a little more palatable, or you can drink it on a day-to-day basis, you can cook in it, but the purity of the water, the reliability of the purity of the water, that's key. And currently, the purity of water is sort of under threat around the world. So, Thilo, we're going to talk to you about water. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you so much for hosting me here.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get on to your expertise on water, its purity, where does it come from, how do we maintain supplies into the future, let's go back a little into the past. How did you become a scientist? What were those moments when you were smaller and you said, ha-ha, there's a career?
Yeah, you would love it. You think about that, somebody is sitting there and thinking, what should I do in future and should I become a scientist? Completely different. It is because my father broke his leg. That's the reason I became scientist. So you would ask, why? What's the reason why? So the thing was that my mother was planning to go skiing in Switzerland together with my father. My father broke his leg, so they asked me, well, can you step in? And I said, of course, I'm going. So I went for a nice skiing trip to Switzerland. And the friends of my parents, this guy, he was geologist and scientist. And I was skiing with him for 7 months, and he asked me, what do you want to do? And be very honest, after high school, I had no real idea what to do.
How old were you
do.
Then?
18.
18, okay.
So I had no clear idea what to do. In Germany, you have to go to a military service afterwards, so it was some time to go. And then I thought, like, well, I have no idea. And then he told me about geology and how great this is. And he was actually working in water, and he told me about, well, that's it's great. It's of everything a little bit mass, a little bit chemistry, a little bit physics, not too much, of course, and a lot of traveling. And here we go. This sounded so great. And then I said, oh, that's what I wanted to do, and I enrolled in geology. Pure coincidence. I never heard of this before.
Which university did you enroll in?
A small university north of Frankfurt in Germany called Gießen University. I stayed for a year and then went to Technical University in Berlin.
Okay. That's a very famous university.
Yeah.
I got some good friends there. So there you are. You go to Berlin to study geology. Now, what does studying a geology degree mean in Germany? Is you just concentrate only on geology? You would do more in Britain, or would it be rather like in North America where you've still got to do history and economics and a whole range of things and some geology?
First, it sounds more like in Britain. Like you have to do, of course, like I said, you have to do a little bit chemistry, physics, and a little bit maths, but to be honest, not too much. This comes later. And then it's about geology. And to be very honest, it's a little bit like a travel agency because of course, in Berlin, you know Berlin, that's flat, you only get the sand and boring countryside. So they said, and it was, you know the situation was Eastern Germany, a capital on this side, and they said, okay, we need to go somewhere to see the real geology. And this was like a travel agency. So the excursions were to Portugal, to Britain, were to the U.S., to Brazil. So we traveled a lot, even with the students. As undergraduate, and I really loved it to be in the field side and the countryside, do math. Mapping, do analysis of rocks, and this was great. It was very general geology, and then just later with the master, you specialize to something. And there I specialized to groundwater and doing research in groundwater.
But, I mean, that's an expensive proposition.
It is.
I mean, how many geology majors, as we say here, were there in your year?
I would say at our university about 10 to 15 left every year. And still nowadays at Vienna University, we have about 10, 15, 20 who finish a master every year. And I just had a talk to the president some years ago, and he said, do you know what? Geology is one of the most expensive studies we have.
Absolutely.
And that's true.
Not because of instrumentation only, but because of travel?
Right. Well, also a lot of travel. Traveling and doing this excursion is a great part. But to be very honest, it's great. It's much more than science. You learn a lot about different countries, about diversity. You learn a lot about different people and how things are going over there.
Well,
that's very important.
Right,
very
to see important. Solutions to problems that you have that maybe you didn't even think about because of your environment.
Yeah, absolutely, because you're traveling to countries and you learn how they're solving this. However, to be honest, after the bachelor, I thought a little bit it is too theoretical, and then I decided I need a break. I want to work. And then I went to Colombia and I stayed 1 year in Colombia, close to Bogota, and was working in water abstraction, water wells. And I just learned that really being on the job as engineer and working, I learned problem is I don't really understand the processes. Yeah, there are so much things about contaminants and quality and everything. And even there, the consultancies, there was never enough money and time. And I thought, I want to dig deeper. Yeah. And then I decided that I want to go for my major. And I did my master thesis. I did my master thesis in Brazil, in the dry area of Brazil, in the Sertão, which is the northeastern part. A few words of Portuguese still remain. And did the same thing about how do you find water in a very dry area in a more or less desert. And there you could learn easily that it is most about politics. Yeah. Geology is one thing. But drilling wells and where the well is drilled and how the water is distributed, this is much about elections and much about power. So I enjoyed this. And during my master, I learned that, hey, there's still much more to learn. And I was very curious and said, okay, I'm going on with the PhD.
Before we get on to your later studies, I was always impressed. I think it's in Peru, up in the Alto Plano, where they collect water by evening when the temperature goes down. And then they have these wires that they stretch out so that the condensation comes onto the wire and then drips into a container, right?
Absolutely.
When I first heard that, I thought, my goodness, we are very imaginative and clever people, right? Because this is one of the driest parts of the world.
Absolutely. To the cold ocean upwelling, it's so right. Super dry air. So you need the condensation of the wet air in the evening. Yeah. What they're doing also in the Atacama Desert over there, which is great and it's working. And then the Caroni Islands. The forest is just because the trade winds are going a little bit up and you get the condensation of the wet air. Else it would be a desertification.
They actually collect water in the same way?
Not in the same way. It's just like the ecosystem works by the trees.
Right. Anyway, so you went then for PhD. Where did you study for this?
I went to a small university, Bremen University.
Bremen is special because it's got a city government.
Right.
Which is unlike
most of the rest. And it's the poorest city in Germany.
The poorest.
One of the poorest cities.
But it's also one of the left-wing
absolutely,
cities.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it is.
We used to admire it, I must say, from a distance.
Right. It's Göttingen and Bremen, which are these universities. So I studied at Bremen University, had a lot of fun, and then went deeper into water. And Bremen was a fantastic university. It was really, really great. They had a lot of funding over there, which is important because many of these environmental problems, they really rely on state funding, and which is important. And I got a great education over there.
Without funding, it's very difficult to do modern science, right?
I mean, it's difficult to impossible.
And it's very difficult. I don't know about in Germany, but right now there's sort of, I wouldn't call it an attack on science, but there's a skepticism about what science
is. We had the March on Science last weekend, also in Santa Barbara,
right.
Where I'm hosted at the moment.
Had one right here in town, too.
Right.
And so, you know, the society shelling out money for scientists. I mean, for example, I've said this on the radio many times, I'm not doing science to solve big world problems. You are. You're trying to sort of find out how we can sustain ourselves with water supplies. I rather like to play games and making molecules that people have never made before without really knowing what the properties are. That's a luxury, and I understand that. But what you're doing is sort of more fundamental. So let's talk. What are you doing? What is your shtick on water?
Well, my shtick still, I would have to say, is also playing. I think science is always like playing. That's what it is. You need curiosity. If I look to my kids, yeah, I got three daughters, 2-year-old, 12-year, and 15-year-old, and I can really see that sometimes, I mean, school is so important. They're all at public schools, which is really great. But I would say creativity with the youngest one is so good. They just explore. I would say all kids are natural scientists. They want to explore. They want to learn. So you just need to keep this curiosity in ourselves awake. So I'm curious. That's the point. I want to know about things. I could have studied something different.
And you'd like to know about things a long way from home.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I could do things. What I'm doing at the moment, I started with water as a coincidence. Could have been something else. But there are so many open questions. I want to understand how things work. What is it about? How do contaminants behave in the water? How are groundwaters or surface waters contaminated? Is there a danger? Is there a threat? Can we clean them up? What is a smart way to do so? Is it very smart to pollute first a river and then to think about cleaning it up? Or is it smarter to contain the contaminants maybe even at the household or at the hospital or agriculture? What is the right way to do so? And what I'm investigating is about groundwater resources. How much groundwater do we have? Where is it coming from? Understand the flow of the groundwater to know where we can take it in a sustainable way that the groundwater levels are not dropping and dropping and dropping and dropping. I mean, you see the big problems, for example, in California in the last 6 years.
Oh, fortunately, Texas also.
Fortunately, it has been raining, and Texas, of course, is a problem. But then also about these resources might also be used for the next generations. You know, if I ask in my classes how old is groundwater, is it a day or a week or 10 years or 20 years? And then we play democracy, and I just raise my hand, and people have no idea. Groundwater could be easily 10,000 years old. Yeah, so groundwater you might use in Texas maybe is 10,000 years old, or could be 1,000 years old. This is still a fresh and nice groundwater, 100 years, something like this. So problem is, if we contaminate this, for example, with backflow of fracking. Yeah, fracking is a big issue. If we contaminate our waters, then the next generations will have no chance to use these waters anymore. So I think groundwater protection is really important because processes are slow. So we need to rely on a fundamental understanding, on modeling, to predict this. Because we cannot wait 100 years to see the result. Then it's too late. We have a fundamental understanding, much needed, to make good and smart predictions.
That's absolutely true. And the idea that if you're lucky enough to have a well somewhere up in the panhandle of Texas and it's good potable water, but when you drink it, it can be 10,000 years old.
Right.
Right? And that's gone. I mean, you just swallowed it. And it's not going to come back for another 10,000 years if you're lucky. So in Europe, is that so much of a problem? Because here we have these very arid areas. You know, West Texas is, you're in one right now, Southern California. It doesn't rain a lot, all right? And so they've diverted rivers and done phenomenal engineering feats to provide water to Los Angeles, Las Vegas. But in Europe, you don't have that many really, well, I never have seen any, really arid areas, maybe in the middle of Spain. But the rest of Europe, in Germany, France, etc., and Britain, certainly, there's enough rain to go around. So the pressures are different.
The pressures are different, as you said. It's a question from which perspective are you looking from. From a British perspective, it's maybe raining a little bit too much or not, but there, of course, is not the problem. Germany, the same. If you go to Southern Europe, things are really changing. Southern Italy, Southern Spain, and Greece have tremendous problems with water shortage. And the predictions for climate change in the upcoming years, and I'm not talking about the extreme scenarios, I'm talking about the average scenarios, which are very plausible, show that heat waves will be stronger, rain events will be shorter, and groundwater replenishment will be less. So groundwater levels are going down. So we have water shortage in Europe and the southern regions. In the northern regions, the problem is a different one. It is about contamination. So if you look to countries like the mother of industrialization, Great Britain, or a heavy industrialized country like Germany, where I'm from, of course, groundwater contamination is the issue. So it is not about the quantity of the groundwater. It is that many of these groundwater resources have been contaminated by heavy industry or dispersed industry. It could be from the dry cleaner facility to a smelter, yeah? From the little actions locally in a dry cleaner or a filling station which leaks, and they often leak. Yeah,
apparently they do, yes.
They do, and the dry cleaners also they do, or to factories who are working with metals and using degreasing agents or something. To large industry complexes like in Germany in the Ruhrgebiet area where they have all these heavy rust belt industry alive. So quality is the one thing, quantity the others. In the U.S. you have both. You have quality and quantitative issues.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Thilo Hoffmann from the Department of Environmental Geosciences, University of Vienna, Austria. We're talking about water, and there's lots more to talk about. So stick around. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Thilo Hoffmann from the Environmental Geosciences Department at the University of Vienna. And Thilo, you're just saying that, you know, environmental pollution of water is the main issue that you're looking at in the northern tier of Europe. And you went through a litany of well-known locations, petrol stations, gas stations, whatever. There's also a lot of responsibility on the people, because more and more you know that people are taking medications, they're taking birth control pills, they're taking Lipitor for cholesterol, and all that goes down the toilets usually. And that is also becoming a major impact. Certainly, I read about it in North America. Presumably, that's absolutely the same in Europe.
The big problem is, I'm just joking, it's not a problem, but the thing is, analytics have changed completely in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, I opened a bottle of water. It was pristine and fresh. We just could analyze 200 parameters, and we found nothing. Nowadays, you open a bottle of water, the same bottle, and you analyze it with these modern mass spectrometers, and you find 10,580 compounds. And the problem is that we just recently are able, in the last 10 years, to analyze these compounds and also to know they are there, but we still don't know how do they interact. How do the risk of the individual compound add up to the next one? Let's say, for example, blood lipid or antidepressives or antibaby pill or others. Point is that the concentration then after the sewage water treatment plant is very low. It's, of course, much below anything where you know that it works. But we don't know enough how this cocktail adds up. And this is very complicated science. What is the addition of all these things? So that's the question you ask. It would or might be smart to retain more of these contaminated waters at the source and not then later to think about how to treat a contaminated river.
Exactly. And the pity is, I suppose, that you don't have access to historical bottles of water to go back and say, look, it's the same water that your grandmother drank, that we don't know what was in the water because we didn't have the analytical capacity and now we don't have any samples. That's an interesting question. Are there historical samples of water that you could go back and analyze to point out to the lay public and to yourselves, hey, it's not as bad as you might think because that's what water's always contained. There's going to be new things, I understand.
Well, it's sure not the case. The things which are there are new because we know very good from data what is taken by the public. Just consider 100 years back. How was the medical system? How much medical aid was there available on the market? And what are the tons what are taken? And I'm not talking only about what you take. 99% is leaving your body. That's important. Also about what you throw away. Much of the medicines you buy, they are just thrown away and go something at the waste dump side, which is also a problem. With the wine bottle, that's an interesting idea. This exists in a way from snow or from ice. So you can drill, of course,
down
in ice or old glaciers and get the water samples. And there, and this is done, you get a great picture of ancient air pollution. So you can really trace back many, many decades about air pollution. So air pollution is something where we have this.
Have you been involved in any of that?
No, I'm not working in air pollution, which was also so interesting. So many nice things to study. I would start again and study something different.
So tell us exactly what's your current big topic at the moment. What is it that you're really in the middle of now? And can you see an end to that project?
Right in the middle, we're working with two things. The one thing is nanotechnology. You all heard about nanotechnology. It's emerging technology. It's maybe a big driver in industry. It's a multi-billion dollar market. And of course, like with all new technologies, once it's on the market, and it is on the market, you see nano polish whatsoever or nano cosmetics like scrubbers for your face. Once it's on the market, it's released to the environment. And we're working together a lot with the U.S. colleagues here in El Paso and other universities and in the U.S. What is the effect of these nanoparticles to the environment? And we're doing a lot of research trying to understand this in a very complex way in a complex system. And that's important because different than with pesticides, let's say, 30, 40 years ago, where industry claimed this is impossible for atrazine that it ever reaches groundwater. And then, of course, 10 years later, we found it in the groundwater, which was impossible. Here, I would say that industry really supports this very much. Sometimes I have to say I got the bad feeling that industry even supports this more than the state authorities at the moment. I'm a little bit ashamed of this. But industry pushes forward. That's of liability reasons. They want to know what the products are doing. So I would say 20 years ago, it was that the state was doing the environmental protection laws and enforcement. They're still doing this. And they also funded the project. I got the fear, and it's not only fear, that's reality, that now the state steps back a little bit and leaves this to industry, which I found a little bit frightening. For nanotech, I would say things are running in a way. Okay, industry is a lot involved and there's a lot of research going on. What are the environmental implications of nanotechnology to ecosystems?
Give us some examples of nanotechnology that everybody would be familiar with.
Okay, a simple one is, you know, these anti-smelling socks. Nobody wants to smell in our society now. So this is important. This has been different 100 years ago. There is a little bit of history about hygiene. So you got these anti-smelling socks with silver or anti-smelling socks with silver inside. And this silver kills bacteria. And bacteria are the one who forms the acid which is smelling. So that's the reason the silver is inside. What happens, of course, the silver is washed out. After 2, 3, 4, 5 washing cycles, the silver is out of the product in the train. So
we also anti-smell socks. No, I don't wear socks, but they only last for 4 or 5 issues.
Yeah, it's of course it's not labeled on the product, but that's what it's in. You wash them, or then you better don't wash them. We can discuss this, but not washing the socks. But after 4, 5, 6 washing cycles of your shirt or the socks, the silver is out. Other product is sunscreen. Sunscreen. You need to take sunscreen nowadays, yeah, ozone hole, UV radiation, yeah, we know about skin cancer is very prominent in Europe and the US, so we're using sunscreen. But you remember these old days when you had this sticky white stuff and you looked like a goose? That's over. Why? Because you get nano formulations. The titanium dioxide is in a nano formulation, so you can't see it anymore. It's smaller than the wavelength of light. So these are these modern sunscreens have titanium dioxide in it.
And so then
that's the consumer products.
Right, absolutely. Now, what do you know about their appearance in water?
Well, very easy. You can think about this. You put the sunscreen on your body. If you go swimming then, of course, it is released. It doesn't stay in your skin. So it is
really... You have a shower. I mean, at some stage, it's going to go.
You have a shower. Right. It goes off. So And then it's released. It's going to the wastewater, or it's going to your lake, or it's going to the marine ecosystem at low concentrations, but it's going there. It's released. And that's one thing we investigated. What is then the behavior of these titanium nanoparticles from sunscreen, for example? Another example on the debate is...
Well, before you go to another example, what's the story? I mean, is this a problem? Or is the half-life, if I can put it that way, of the titanium nanoparticle short enough that it simply dissipates into some other form, which is perhaps not a potential hazard?
Right. We were exactly asking these questions. We did some tests with higher concentrations. If there is an impact, we saw, yes, there is an impact at high concentrations. And then we compared to realistic concentrations, even if you have a lot of bathers in a lake. And we found out, no, there is no risk, which is a good message. It is just like the titanium concentrations out of the sunscreens are much, much lower than the natural background, and it is not more toxic than the natural titanium. So many of these nanoparticles have natural equivalents out there. So we found out that it is no risk and not of a concern.
This is the good news.
That's
then.
The good news. So right. The natural so background with the natural titanium is much higher.
Go out tomorrow and buy more sunscreen with titanium oxide in there.
Yeah. Right? From this perspective, it's not a problem. If you want to talk with me about the additives to the sunscreen, preservatives like parabens or other additives like UV filters, the organics, that's a different story, but that's a different topic.
You mean
than
that's the carrier for the titanium oxide?
It's not the carrier. It's the active ingredients. You have these chemical UV filters and mineral UV filters. So I would say most of the threats...
Oh, so what you're saying, hang on, so I get it right so the listener can, that a sunscreen which is a titanium-based has other materials in there to screen out different
absolutely.
UV.
Absolutely. Just look at the labeling. You get 20 or 30 compounds in. So titanium is one of the UV filters, but you got, of course, also chemical UV filters. And these substances, especially fragrances, they are much of the concern for the water bodies. They are used much too far. They are washed off. Some of them, they're persistent. Or even if they're not persistent, the transformation product, it could also be dangerous.
So are you seeing that when you do your analyses? You see these fragmentation patterns or fragmentation particles or materials from the sunscreen? That's much higher level.
This is investigated that consumer products release, especially like fragrances or preservatives, to water bodies. And that's of a concern. That's of a problem.
Okay.
That you get too high concentrations.
But just to settle the listener who's getting a little anxious, these materials can be readily removed by water treatment.
Not all of them. That's a problem. There are two classes. There are the classes of compounds which are easily adsorbed in a wastewater treatment plant. But the concern are the compounds which are very soluble in water, and that's where research nowadays is directed to. So we have a bunch of contaminants which are highly water soluble, which are passing the wastewater treatment plant. Some of them might be degraded. But degraded doesn't mean end of story. It means they are transformed to something else, which might be even more toxic or less. No. That's to be investigated.
Well,
we will have a lot of things to investigate in the next 10, 20 years. That's the nice thing about science.
Well, yes, but.
But.
And with all science, there is going to be a but. I quote you yourself there. We've almost run out of time, but I remember I've done many programs on water here with people who are involved in actually supplying the water supply to El Paso. I think of Ed Archuleta, a wonderful fellow that has really made El Paso much more safe with respect to future water, because there was a time 30, 40 years ago when they were thinking we wouldn't have any water. But now we recycle, and you know, what you flush today, you drink tomorrow, and there's desalination plants. But I've lived for many months in Mexico, and there, you know, the water you drink comes around and you buy it in a big gallon container. Mm-hmm. But the water in the tap, you don't drink it, but you use it for everything else.
Right.
Is there a movement towards that at all in Europe? Because you can almost, the amount of money we spend on purifying water so that every drop that comes out of the tap we can drink, you could save all that money and give away good potable water in bottles.
My opinion is very simple. The smartest thing you can do is protect the natural groundwater and protect the rivers, because then you save the money, because you can drink the water directly, lightly treated, out of the tap. That's much more meaningful.
It's a better way to go.
It's a better way to go than to sell bottled water.
Okay, so we can desist drinking our Malvern water or our Perrier water and treat our
water. There's a very interesting study just coming out from China, and China is the same, that it's going more to more to bottled water. And then they investigated how safe is bottled water. And you would wonder how many bottled water is not safe and contaminated at the source. Another topic.
Another topic, and a depressing one, I'm sure. But we maybe come back to it, Tilo. It's been a lot of fun. Tilo, very interesting. We've come to the end of the program. I'd like to thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It was great talking to you.
Oh, no, this has been a lot of fun. And to the audience, again, we've been talking to Tilo Hoffmann. He's a professor of environmental geosciences, University of Vienna. We'll be back next week with another fascinating science studio. Take care.